Big show for you here today. Trevor Sikkema joins the podcast for yet another Mock Draft Monday episode. Man, this is an absolute banger here. We have five of Trevor's favorite player to team fits from his most recent mock draft. We have yet another Tet McMillan landing spot. I think this one makes a ton of sense. Why the 49ers need this guy to complete a defensive overhaul. And Seahawks fans, we're not giving you an interior offensive lineman, but Trevor has a great option for you in the middle of the first round. And finally, who's the player that Trevor is willing to stand on the table for? All that and more coming up on today's show. Let's get into it. It's Monday, March 17th. I'm Matt Harmon. Welcome to the Yahoo Fantasy Forecast, and it is. It's a hell of a day to talk ball. We're turning off our free agency brain for a second, although I'm sure there will be some tie-in here, because it's Mock Draft Monday, and as we always do, we bring in one of the great mock drafters, one of the great draft analysts, one of the great, like, just straight-up football guys in the industry right now. It is my good buddy, here to talk a little ball, Trevor Sikkema of Pro Football Focus. Trevor, what's going on, man?
Matt, so good to be with you, my friend. Really great to be back on the show. Appreciate you having me. I'm hoping that we can get through enough mock draft talk to where maybe at the end we can talk about how great the Carrillo drink is that you and I are now both big fans of, that we talked about during the combine week. So it's good to be with you, my friend.
Yeah, let's put a pin in that, because we're gonna finish the show with that discussion, because it's worth having here on the airwaves. But for the new folks who are uninitiated here, Mock Draft Monday, it's very simple. We're talking mock drafts. Mock drafts, and Trevor knows this because he does them. You love them, you hate them. They're just part of the ecosystem, okay? It is what we're doing here during draft season. But, you know, instead of going pick by pick, or, okay, like, you don't love all of them. I know you guys that do it, you don't love all of them, but there's always a couple of picks in there, maybe a few, that you're like, okay, this player to team fit, this is beautiful. And that's what we bring people on to do. We talk through five of their favorite potential player to team fits. And at the end of the podcast, we also ask the guest, Trevor will do it this week, to stand on the table for one prospect that you absolutely love. I got to give you props, Trevor, because we don't always go back and number one, we haven't had that many repeat people. We just started doing it this year. But you were on with us last season, and you nailed two of them, both quarterbacks. You had the Vikings trading up for J.J. McCarthy, and you had the Broncos actually trading back to get Bo Nix. They didn't trade back. They took Bo Nix at 12. And I got to give you a lot of credit on that one in particular, Trevor, because there were a lot of Bo Nix haters out there, okay? Very, very skeptical about the whole Bo Nix situation, but you had a lot of good things to say about him. You nailed the team fit here. And, you know, obviously Broncos had a better season than myself and many people expected.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of my favorite landing spots for Bo Nix. You know, when we talked about, hey, how many quarterbacks are we going to get in the first round? Well, it would have needed to go to the right spot. I think when you look at the guys at the top, you know, with Drake May and Jaden Daniels and Caleb Williams, I mean, any team that had any sort of a quarterback need was going to be interested in those guys. That wasn't necessarily going to be the case for Bo. I thought that he could have potentially been a first-round pick. Now, I didn't know we were going to get six quarterbacks in the first 12 picks. That was pretty crazy. But again, it made sense where he was going, given who the head coach and the play caller was. I loved him getting in Sean Payton's offense. And I think I probably said this on this show, because I said it a lot last year. I don't think that Bo Nix is Drew Brees, but I think he approaches the game like Drew Brees does. And I feel like the way that he would process Sean Payton's offense would be very beneficial for both parties. And for a team that really needed a quarterback, if they weren't going to be able to get, again, Caleb or Jaden or Drake May, he was my favorite of the rest of those guys to go to that specific spot. And so I'm glad that we got to see it happen, not just because, you know, selfishly I like being right, but also the fact that I always love when these talented football players go to the best spots and we get to see those talents shine. So it was cool to see him and what he was able to do as a rookie. He even overshined my expectations of what he was going to be like in his first year in that system. But I just think that it laid a lot of great groundwork for what he could be with Sean Payton as his head coach.
Yeah, I mean, beyond the selfish and cheap SEO play of the title of this show, that's also why I like doing this, is because this was what it's all about. Like, not every prospect is a fit for every team. Not every team is a fit for every player. We know this, mm-hmm. but when you get that right marriage between play caller and quarterback, or, you know, defensive system with a certain guy who's maybe kind of a tweener. It can really all work out. And just before we throw to your picks, because you don't have the Broncos here, but now that my brain is I've been thinking about the Broncos a lot, man, after free agency. And that team is going to be, number one, a pain in the ass to play against on defense. They've got, like, with their with Talofufunga, you know, they got Greenlaw in there. Like, they got some I don't know, just badasses, some ass kickers back there, along with an already very good defense in the secondary that can play a lot of man coverage. You got Zach Allen coming off of a great year. And, I mean, you know this, Trevor, offensively, they've got weaknesses at running back and tight end and kind of, you know, what Sean Payton calls the Joker. This is a great draft to fill those needs. So, like, a good draft by the Broncos, man, I could see myself getting really excited about Bo Nix and the boys this year.
No doubt. And if they were in the NFC, we talk about this team as a playoff team, you know, especially from what the defense was last year. They just happen to be in the more stacked conference where you get so many juggernaut powerhouse teams that are playing so well. In the NFC, it's a little bit more top heavy, and a lot of those playoff spots are still sort of not spoken for yet. So if they were in the NFC, I feel like we would be very common to talk about the Broncos as one of those potential playoff teams because of what we saw from their offense already last year. They've got a pretty good offensive line. They got to get a running back in there that can really complement what they've been able to do in the passing game. That Joker position, I was fascinated to listen to Sean Payton talk about getting that middle of the field type of a weapon, whether it's a tight end slash wide receiver, a wide receiver slash running back. He's had those types of players throughout his years when he was the head coach of the New Orleans Saints, and he wants to try to get a guy like that this year. I think that Tyler Warren could have been that perfect player from Penn State, the tight end from Penn State. He's probably not going to make it to them at number 20. Colston Loveland, though, the tight end from Michigan, could be an option there for them. I think he makes a ton of sense, but there's a lot of guys throughout the rest of the draft that could be sort of those hybrid players, you know, Cam Scataboo and everything that he can be as a receiver as well as a runner. Elijah Arroyo, what he can be as a receiving tight end slash slot wide receiver type of a player. There's a lot of different options. So you're right. It's exciting times to be a Broncos fan because you feel good about who you have at head coach. You had a top 10, top 5 defense in some ways last year that only got more talent this offseason. So Broncos are headed in the right direction, man. They're a fun team to follow.
Yeah, like I said, they've just been dancing around the brain lately, this Denver Broncos team, for me. So I'm glad we had that quick little discussion on them. But let's get into the meat of the show here today. Give me your first player to team fit from your latest mock draft that you absolutely loved.
So the first one that I'm going to go for, and obviously there, yeah, like you said, some mock draft picks that you love more than others. But the one that I absolutely love, I don't know if we're going to get it. The New England Patriots getting Tetsuro McMillan, the wide receiver from Arizona, to me, would just be so much fun. When we talked to Mike Vrabel at the combine when he was doing his combine presser, I thought that he would just be like, yeah, I mean, we're gonna build the trenches. We got to build the trenches first. Because let's face it, the Patriots roster sucked last year. There's a reason why they weren't a good football team. The coaching staff didn't really have a good grip on what was going on. That was true. But this was also one of the least talented rosters in the NFL. So we knew that they were going to have to sort of start from ground zero. And Mike Vrabel, big trenches guy. You know, he wins football and it's funny, you would call it like quote unquote old school ways. It's just how you win. You got to win up front. You got to have a good defensive line and an offensive line. This is the worst offensive line in the NFL last season. They gave up the most pressures. I believe they gave up the most sacks. And so I figured that that would be the heavy part of the emphasis. But Vrabel, when he was at his podium session, talked about the benefits and the need to get a dominant outside receiver, how much that can help a young quarterback like Drake May. And for me, Tetsuro McMillan's the best one in this class. We're recording this show, you know, mid-free agency, and as much as they have really beefed up the defensive side of the ball, they haven't really done much on offense, especially at receiver. They brought in Mac Hollins, but that was really it. You know, they have Jalen Polk and Javon Baker, who I think that they just believe are going to be better than they were in their rookie seasons. I do as well. But imagine Tetsuro McMillan on this team. This is a 1,000-yard receiver next year, in my opinion. With what we saw from Drake May, if they get McMillan, McMillan is a 1,000-yard rookie wide receiver next year in this offense. He automatically becomes the guy that they want to throw the ball to. He's such an alpha in those contested catch situations. He's got the size. He's got the catching strength, great coordination. And he's got a little bit after the catch that you wouldn't expect. It reminds me of when Vrabel was in Tennessee. Now, I'm not saying that they're exactly the same player, but how much he was comfortable leaning on A.J. Brown to be that, you know, go ball, deep ball, alpha type of receiver who he's open even when he's not. And I feel like that mentality could also exist for McMillan. So the fact that I love Drake May so much in last year's class, the fact that he showed you some promise, even as a rookie and not great in a not great environment last year, if you put McMillan on this team, I think it's going to be a lot of fun.
Man, Mike Vrabel, you can tell he's still caught up on the A.J. Brown thing. You know, so you bringing it up is not out of place here because, and we I don't think it's hard to forget that he said, as long as I'm the head coach of the Tennessee Titans, A.J. Brown's going to be playing here. General manager trades him. And I always loved Vrabel during those, during the draft, you know, when they'd go to the Tennessee Titans room, he was like shaking his head, like making it clear, this is not me. This is not my thing. Even when Rand Carthon was there, his first draft together, and he took Will Levis, you could see him like talking to Vrabel, like, no, this is what the guy brings to the table. Vrabel's like clearly not into it. Guy wears his emotions on his sleeve, and I do respect that. So he's still clearly, again, caught up on the A.J. Brown era and knows the value of that type of player. Now, McMillan here at 4, Trevor, it seems like since we were at the combine, he's sort of been a guy that maybe because he didn't run and sort of just the unknown variable of what is his timed speed, it seems like he's, you know, quote, falling down media draft boards and stuff like that. You clearly are still thinking he's a potential top 5 pick here. I really like McMillan, but what do you make of this kind of skepticism around his game in general?
I don't really know what it's based off of, because if you want to say like, hey, you know, his separation scores are low, he's not the fastest wide receiver in the world, neither was Drake London. London didn't do anything at the combine. London didn't do anything his pro day.
Yeah, never ran a 40.
He went 8 overall, and he's absolutely worth it. He's a stud. He's a wide receiver 1 in the NFL. So I don't really know why we're not trusting what happened with Drake London when Tetrone McMillan is a very similar player who wins in a lot of similar ways. And the last couple of years, he had some takeover games for Arizona, even though the team wasn't as good as they wanted to be this past year. But I don't really understand it, because you ask some people, I mean, we've been pretty unwavering at PFF. We've had Tetrone McMillan as a top 10 prospect, basically wire to wire, since we had our initial big board come out, or at least the early adjusted one in the early parts of the season up until now. You know, he's a top 8 prospect for me overall, but you see some other big boards and they're adjusting to like post combine stuff. And, you know, sometimes Tetrone McMillan's in the teens. I've seen some people like have him like early 20s, and I just go, man, what am I missing with this guy? Now, understandably, if you're the Miami Dolphins, right? And you're just a team that's just building everything that you do around speed. Okay. Yeah. He's not going to be for you, but for the team that really is going to invest into what he is as a football player, I don't really understand why we're poking so many holes in his game. I think that he's a stud and a future wide receiver 1. So I'm a little perplexed on why we're not trusting some players who have similar skill sets, who have won in as dominant of ways and consistently as he has, why we're not trusting that translation to the pros.
Yeah, honestly, I don't think he's really a Drake London type prospect to me. I think he's a little ticked down, but he's very similar to like Courtland Sutton to me. And Courtland Sutton's a guy that, yeah, maybe Courtland Sutton you're best off if he's your 2, but you can, we just talked about the Broncos, you can run an offense with him as your number 1 receiver. So if Tet McMillan becomes even a Courtland Sutton type player, and by the way, Sutton ran a 4.54 at his combine, 36th percentile according to Mock Draftable. I mean, maybe Tet is slower than that. I've heard people kind of posits that concern that he might be a 4.6 type player or whatever. Mm-hmm. And in that case, if you're going to run a 4.6, yeah, you're right. Just don't even bother running, even though now it's just kind of being inferred. But like, again, if he's 4.54, like we're in the same ballpark there. I think that's the comp for me that I really like. And yeah, look, this is where, again, the player fit is so important, Trevor, because even if he's like Sutton, like an average separator in the NFL. And to me, I think he's a guy that looks like he will be an average to maybe slightly above average separator at his very best. That's fine. Like, again, Sutton is that player because he can also win with physicality. He can also win with a guy like Drake May who's comfortable. I mean, dude, Drake May was putting up contested passes to freaking Kayshon Booty last year. You think he's not going to like playing with the 6'4" plus guy there? And again, that intermediate area, the inbreaking routes where I do think he separates really well. Mm-hmm. That's what you know, Drake May made his money with like Josh Downs and those guys at college. Mm-hmm. So I really like this fit a lot, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and look, if you see him more as a Courtland Sutton type of a player, Sutton went in the second round. He went 40th overall. So, like, I get it, that he would be a little bit lower. I'm just a little bit higher on him. I do think that he's a little bit closer to, like, what Drake London was. And I think that when you look at some of the speed concerns, they're definitely there. Like, he's not going to be a burner for you. Like, it's just not going to happen. But he does have some pretty good in-game athletic scores from PFF over the last couple of years. And so I sort of trust a little bit of that and sort of what I've seen. And he also has that mentality to be more of a yards-after-catch guy than most big receivers who win the way that he does. And I lean into that playmaker mentality as well. So I think this is a pretty good fit with him going to the Patriots. I agree. It'd be a lot of fun to see him and Drake May together.
Yeah, I only mean Sutton as more of like a career comp where sure. I mean, yeah, not as a prospect. I actually like Tet significantly more than I liked Cortland Sutton as a prospect. But yeah, no, again, we're same archetype of player, the better separator than you think, X receiver archetype. I think Tet McMillan fits into that group there. But all right, let's go to your second favorite fit here from your most recent mock draft.
So the second favorite fit that I have here is the San Francisco 49ers getting Mason Graham, the defensive tackle from Michigan. Now, I don't know if this is something that they're going to be able to do. I don't know if he's going to be available for them at number 11, but with Mason Graham showing up lighter and with a little bit shorter arms even than we thought was going to be the case, I just feel as though his range is now wide open between, I would say, pick 5 and pick 15. Now, if you just trust in the tape here, I would tell you that he should be a top 8 lock no matter what. Like if he gets to Carolina, he gets no further down than Carolina, or at the very least the New Orleans Saints, given what we have seen from free agency and how those guys have navigated that. I think he's just too damn good of a football player. But when you look at him specifically with the San Francisco 49ers, being that 3 technique defensive tackle for Robert Saleh's defense, in my opinion, is huge. They would emphasize him the same way that he was able to do so with Quinnen Williams, who was able to have good production when he was out there and healthy. Now that he's back as the defensive coordinator for the Niners, and they just straight up have to be a lot better, right? I mean, like Malik Collins no longer on the team. Leonard Floyd's no longer on the team. Javon Hargrave's no longer on the team. And this is already a defensive line that was really bad against the run last year. Mason Graham's had elite defensive run defense grades, over the last 2 seasons. So he immediately becomes a really nice interior slash edge duo with Nick Bosa there. And I think I think you can absolutely build a future defensive line around these couple of guys. So to me, it's just a massive scheme fit. If he is anywhere within that conversation, maybe even they pop up a little bit, because I think they have 12 draft picks right now. The San Francisco 49ers do. So they could even maybe get a little bit aggressive and try to trade up a little bit if he has fallen. I think that he is a huge fit for this team. And I really like this one a lot for San Francisco.
Yeah, well, we've certainly seen the San Francisco 49ers be aggressive and trade up when they have their eyes on somebody. That has not been something we see during the Kyle Shanahan era here. You look at just that front 7 after the departures that you mentioned, you know, Greenlaw as well, and obviously Javon Hargrave. Shoot, man, Joey Bosa kind of getting close to being added, but ultimately becomes a Buffalo Bill, so he doesn't go play with his brother there. That front 7 is basically Nick Bosa, Fred Warner, and
right.
So
very different now.
Very different. So a guy like this, just especially if he can be that run stopper for them and just the tone setter in the middle of that defense, that's huge. Because yeah, this defense I think has been more name than game for several years now.
Yeah, and it's just it's a massive change for the 49ers. And I've sort of said this, is they've gone into free agency, and free agency has sort of proved that. You talked about a couple of guys that were departures on the defensive line, but there's no Charvarius Ward, there's no Dre Greenlaw, there's no Talanoa Hufanga. If you go to the offensive side of things, no Kyle Juszczyk, no Deebo Samuel, no Aaron Banks. And so things are just going to look very different for the 49ers, who are certainly prepping to, it feels like, give Brock Purdy a massive contract. And this is when the bill comes due, if you will. They've had one of the best rosters in the NFL because they've been operating with Brock Purdy being Mr. Irrelevant, having the most, I think, advantageous, valuable contract in NFL history, being the very last pick of the draft when he was there. And yet he was their starting quarterback basically from the jump once he got in that lineup and got a chance to prove himself. So now you're going to have to pay him probably like a top 10, maybe top 5. I don't know what the contract's going to be, quarterback in the league in a second contract. And you just can't have as many guys taking up salary cap numbers outside of the quarterback position. So it's a huge year for the 49ers. And the defensive line, like you said, it's been more name than game for them. I think it's a really good way to put it. And if they can get Mason Graham on that defensive line, to me, it mitigates a massive weakness that they have had and gives them a foundational building block for a pivotal position in Robert Saleh's defense.
Yeah, the 49ers, like you mentioned, are loaded with draft picks. They got a bunch of compensatory picks just within the last 24 hours as we're recording this. They might want to think about keeping some of those picks, you know, because, again, they've been aggressive in the trade-up department. You know what'll help if you're paying Brock Purdy a lot of money? is hitting on some young talent here. And right. I also, by the way, like, I do think the Niners are, I think there's going to be a lot of similar kind of panic, and like, you, I've already seen the graphics on social media, like, look at all the people the Niners have lost. We did this with the Bills last year, right? Where it's like, look at all the names the Bills are losing.
That's, but it's true.
Like, how many of these guys were still like in their prime, you know? So I think the Niners, even if paying like paying Purdy, if a guy like Pearsall hits for them, their first round pick last year, like, the Ayuk stuff is still a little weird, but if he can come back closer to the form he was in 2023 at some point this season, I think the offense can be okay. But defensively, if you're like, is Mason Graham one of these guys that can be like a game ending type pass rusher in addition to being a force against the run? Because to me, like, that's really what they need too.
I think that's the big question, right? And I feel like he was at times throughout his college career, but the NFL is a different beast. And these guys are bigger, they're longer, they're stronger, they're faster. And so, does the arm length issues that Mason Graham has, like, does that really show up in pass rushing? Because we got some great pass rush reps from him. The hands are so violent and quick. He can really, you know, manipulate guys at the college level when it comes to being able to stack and shed or hit push-pull moves, if you want to call it that. He's got a really aggressive and violent, you know, club and arm over or swim type of a combination move there to get into the backfield and to shoot gaps. So I think he's got a great first step. He's a super twitched up type of an offensive lineman when it comes to those 300 pounders, at least. So I think he's got the potential to. The question is just, does the arm length really hold him back from being that? So I at least think he's got the athletic ability to do so. But that is what, you know, I think that the college film alone probably shouldn't make him last until number 11 overall. But if he is there, even if there's a little bit of question mark, and even if it's not the most sure thing in the world that he would be this surefire pass rusher, the potential is there that you would take it, in my opinion, at number 11.
I like it. I like it a lot. I can see the vision on this one for sure. Okay, let's get into your third favorite fit here.
So if this guy lasts until pick number 16, I think that he is perfect. And that is Will Johnson, the cornerback from Michigan, going to the Arizona Cardinals. And the Cardinals have done a decent job addressing some of their defensive line needs over the last couple of years in this free agency, coming to an agreement with Josh Sweat, which they have very much needed. Now, I like the corners that they already have on the team. I like Max Melton. I like Garrett Williams. But they still don't have that CB1. Sean Murphy Bunting's on the team as well. But Will Johnson, in my opinion, could become that immediate CB1 for this team that, you know, still has Buda Baker, has Dadrian Taylor-Demerson as well, a young safety who I think played really, really well in the limited amount of time that he was out there last year. This is a defense that, with Jonathan Gannon, could really take a massive step forward if they get a corner that they have a lot of faith in to play CB1 responsibilities on the outside. So if Will Johnson's able to, and it feels like this is sort of his range now, we talked about him as maybe a top 10 lock at one point. It doesn't feel like we're there anymore. There's some questions on the long speed with him and how limited he was this past year. Didn't put a lot of tape out there for Michigan, dealing with an injury. So I know a lot of people talk about the offensive side of the ball, and obviously Kyler Murray having a really good year this upcoming year is paramount. I thought last year was going to be the year that Kyler Murray was going to look a lot closer towards that MVP season, or the MVP caliber season, I should say, than we had seen since before his knee injury. But he really was still just pretty inconsistent last year. So it has to be much more consistently higher play from Kyler Murray for them to take that next step. But Johnson, in my opinion, doesn't complete their defense because they still have a couple of more pieces they need to add. But adding a high caliber CB1 type of a player would be huge for them. So I really like this fit if he's able to get in that Jonathan Gannon defense.
Yeah. By the way, you've got like kind of the threshold bro like trio here. It's like, what is the 40 time for Tet McMillan? What's the 40 time for Will Johnson? The arm length for Mason Graham, you know, like very draft cliche type stuff. So I like these. I like that you've gone these three right away here. Yeah, the Cardinals are fascinating, man, because I'm with you that Murray, like, I think he just is what he is at this point, you know, and like, that's a guy that you can have as your starting quarterback, and I think you can win with, but like, is he going to be the old truck trailer analogy? Like, is he going to be the truck or is he going to be the trailer? I probably think he's a little bit closer to a trailer. So at this point, what about, like, let's build the rest of the team around him, because it still is a pretty, like, you look at the depth chart last year, there's a lot of holes. Now, there's some interesting names on offense. I think we just got to kind of figure that unit out, deployment more. But, like, defensively, they've done a lot of funky stuff under Jonathan Gannon. Even at times last year, there was a long stretch where they were going super heavy man coverage on late downs, which was weird because they were such a kind of like a passive zone team the year before. So I think they're still almost in the era where they're just throwing stuff at the wall and, like, let's see what works with these players. So for Will Johnson, you know, I think kind of the beyond just the 40 time and all that stuff, and, you know, maybe some injuries and things, the question is the long speed and, like, can he be a man-to-man cover corner? Because I remember watching and charting Rome Odunze and him go against each other in that final game of 2023. And, like, Rome wasn't very productive in that game, but he was definitely giving him the business in man coverage a couple times. They were just, like, Michigan was dominating up front. Michael Penix didn't have the time to find him downfield. So, I mean, even going to the film, I was like, is this a guy that could hold up in man coverage? Where are you at? Or do you think this will be, like, okay, he's with the Cardinals, they lean into more of that zone coverage?
I think they'd lean more into zone, and I feel like Gannon is going to be more of a zone type of scheme if he has his choice. And I wonder if, like you said, like, they switched it up last year just because they were trying to make it work. Maybe it's the opposite. Maybe I'm reading a little bit wrong. I'm reading it wrong, and they went to more man coverage last year because that's actually what they want to do more, instead of just like, hey, these are the personnel guys that we have. We're going to try to get a little bit more aggressive. If you let Will Johnson play more, and, you know, it's really good that you brought this up, because when I went into this season, I thought to myself, okay, corner is above 6 feet tall. He's got good length to him. He's got good footwork, and he's above 200 pounds. It's like man coverage corner, Patch Sertan comp, like it's all right. Like right there for him. And then I watched his games, specifically even what I saw this year. And then I went back to last year because I saw it from a different perspective, and I went, you're an off zone corner, actually. Yeah. Like you are much more of an off zone corner. And we see, you know, he's had the 3 pick-sixes throughout his career. So he obviously knows how to time things well and know how to bait throws and all that kinds of stuff. But even when he's operating, on a normal play-by-play basis, he's so much more comfortable. Now, you could put him in press zone assignments if you want to, but to me, he was so great when he was that off-zone corner. So to be fully transparent, I have Travis Hunter as my CB1 in this class. Mm-hmm. I have Jahdae Barron from Texas as my CB2, and then I have Will Johnson as my CB3, because I think those guys, I like a little bit more of what they bring to the table than Johnson does. But if Gannon leans more into that, like, cover three or quarters structure, I do think that Johnson could be a CB1 for you within what you're asking him to do within that zone coverage scheme. So to me, I agree with you completely. He is it's not that he can't play man coverage, but they aren't his best reps. And so I think that if they are leaning more towards that zone, which I feel like they would want to do, that's why I think that Will Johnson's a fit for me there in Arizona.
I think at his core, that's what Gannon wants to do as well. I think last year it was just, hey, we don't have like an ace pass rusher. Mm-hmm. Let's just try to disrupt things at the line. They did have some guys that were at least comfortable in press coverage and more tighter man situations last year, even if, like, again, it wasn't a super talented roster. But now they have Josh Sweat, who obviously comes from the Eagles. There's familiarity there. They have more of some juice here from a pass rushing department. You know, maybe their early round draft pick last year steps up from, like, a pass rushing perspective. I think it's possible. I think it's possible that they have more juice up front. Therefore, they feel comfortable going into that more quarters coverage, more heavier zone. And I do think Will Johnson fits well with that.
Yeah. It's an ideal landing spot. It's an ideal landing spot, in my opinion, for the Cardinals specifically, because they can, I don't know if they can get a corner upgrade outside of pick 16. Now that you don't want to necessarily just mean like, okay, well, we got to lock in on corner no matter what. But if you draft Will Johnson at 16, I think that gives you a lot of flexibility to dip into a pretty deep edge rusher or interior defensive line class a little bit later in the draft. I think interior offensive line is as well. So the reason why I like this is not just the fit and where I think the Gannon's defense would ideally like to operate, but also just the overall draft strategy of what this team could be, I think makes a lot of sense for them. If they go corner in the first round, get that for sure upgrade if it's a guy like Will Johnson, and then you can go with the interior defensive line, the interior offensive line needs as we get throughout the draft on day 2.
All right, we're going to take our first break. When we come back, we are going to run through some more picks from Trevor's most recent mock draft right after this. All All right, we're back. Trevor, give me your fourth favorite fit here from your most recent mock draft.
Okay, so we've talked about a couple of players. It's funny you were kind of joking about it. I maybe get some speed concerns, maybe get some man coverage concerns, some arm length concerns. I don't know if there's many concerns at all with Nick Emanuori, the safety for South Carolina, because we're so busy just marveling at the fact that this dude is built like a superhero. 6'3", 220 pounds, and yet he's running a sub-4, 440-yard dash, 43-inch vertical jump, over 11-foot broad. I mean, it's just insane explosiveness scores that we have from him as this hybrid defender who can do a lot of things for you. He can play at the linebacker level. He can play slot for you as like an overhang defender. He can play as a strong safety. And you can even play him in single high situations because you probably trust the range and the explosiveness. A coach who I feel like can get the most out of a player like that, because it's not always a guarantee, is Mike McDonald, the head coach of the Seattle Seahawks. At number 18 overall, I have Nick Emanuori going to the Seahawks in my most recent mock because he's got a lot of familiarity with a player similar in versatility in Kyle Hamilton. When he was the defensive coordinator with the Baltimore Ravens, he was able to put Kyle Hamilton in a lot of really advantageous situations to make up for, you know, whether it was weaknesses around the roster or just allow Kyle to for his strengths to shine even brighter. He wasn't afraid to put him in as a free safety. He wasn't afraid to use him as sort of that roaming defender, as a strong safety, as a guy who could play at the linebacker level, somebody who could help out the pass rush and the run defense when he's in the slot. To me, I don't think Emanuori is quite the coverage player that Kyle Hamilton was. You know, Kyle Hamilton goes number four overall because, in my opinion, not only was he versatile as a downhill defender, he was also very versatile as a coverage defender, being comfortable playing in those single high situations, having pretty flexible hip fluidity to be able to just turn and run and locate the football up in the air. I have more doubts about Emanuori when it comes to that coverage ability, but in terms of the versatility of what he could be as a downhill defender, more at the second level in the slot near the line of scrimmage, I trust a guy like Mike McDonald to get the most out of a player like that. So, you know, some people are like, oh, you know, like let's put him with the Miami Dolphins. I know that that's been a common pick for him, but I don't love that fit nearly as much as, again, like Seattle at number 18. Some people have him, let's put him at number 14 to the Indianapolis Colts with Lou Anarumo's defense. I don't know if I love that. I feel like Anarumo's been a guy who's operated a lot more with those two high safeties. And I think it's a little bit less of a, hey, we've got this box defender and downhill defender. And I just feel as though that McDonald's going to look at a player like that and be able to maximize everything that he brings to the table. So again, I'm a little bit more skeptical about Emanuori's coverage ability than I was of a guy like Kyle Hamilton. So it's not like this one in, one out type of a comparison. But I do trust McDonald to get the most out of everything that Emanuori brings to the table.
Yeah, first of all, I do really like this one as well. Like, as you were kind of just painting the picture, I could see him in the Seahawks uniform. I can see him getting deployed all over the place in this defense, which, I mean, yeah, I think Mike McDonald started to really transition things. Like, once they got Ernest Jones in the building, that really solidified the linebacker room. They brought Ernest Jones back. You know, that's critical to this. Leonard Williams was playing some great football for this team last season. Devin Witherspoon, I think, also is sort of like an interchangeable. I mean, he's more of just like a straight up slot corner, but like a chaos causer in the middle of the field. You can get another guy here to sort of play off him in Emanuori. I will say once I like settled with this, I got on board here. My first thought was, man, I can see Seahawks Twitter already. Like, where's the interior offensive line, John? Like, we got a lot of interior offensive linemen that could potentially be first round picks in this draft, and they're just losing it because now Sam Darnold's, you know, still going to be lining up behind some creative players on the interior offensive line. But it's worth noting Seattle has a lot of draft capital. I think, what is it, 5 picks in the top 92. Yeah. In this draft, yes, after everything that they've done here the last few days.
Also, I won't let the Christian Haynes slander stand. I was a big Christian Haynes guy when he was coming through the draft. I know he didn't crack the starting lineup last year, but I genuinely believe he could man one of those guard spots. And the perfect Seahawks interior offensive line player, in my opinion, if we're going to the second round, because now they have pick 50 and 52 because they've got that pick from the Pittsburgh Steelers. That, in my opinion, is the perfect range for Jared Wilson, the center from Georgia, who was one of the best athletes that we saw at the combine for the offensive lineman. He is somebody who can operate that zone blocking scheme, in my opinion, incredibly well. So to me, I understand that, like, looking at their interior offensive line right now, it's like, this is one of the worst interior offensive line units in the league last year. You haven't done anything with this. But I don't love forcing the fit at number 18. I mean, if Kelvin Banks, the offensive lineman from Texas, makes it to them at 18, I would certainly consider it, because for as much as I like Abe Lucas when he is healthy at right tackle, he has had those knee issues that seem to be something that he's going to deal with. Now, I know he said, hey, I'm fully healthy right now. I feel really good. That's great. But he missed a ton of time last year, and they were struggling when he was not in there. So if you draft a guy like Kelvin Banks, you can put him at guard this season. And if Lucas has some knee problems moving forward, you can kick out Kelvin Banks to play offensive tackle for you. So, like, in that situation, okay, I understand them going offensive line. But, like, I wouldn't draft Tyler Booker here I'm the Seahawks. Yeah. Like, I wouldn't draft Tyler Booker there. Gray Zabel, maybe, if you think that he's that caliber of a talent. But I think you might have the opportunity to say, draft a Nicky Manwari, or maybe if one of those top tier wide, like a one of those wide receivers, because DK Metcalf and Tyler Lockett aren't on the team anymore. You know, if a Luther Burden or a Matthew Golden, shoot, at Tat McMillan, obviously, if he makes it to number 18, you'd think about that. And then I really like them just using a lot of that extra draft capital, whether it's where they are right now at 50 and 52, or maybe it's moving up a little bit. Like a world where you're drafting, let's say Nicky Manwari at 18, you get Jared Wilson at 50, you get Alek Iomaner at 52. Like, that's great to me. Like, that's a great haul for the Seattle Seahawks. And then you got some picks a little bit later as well, which you can go for another interior offensive lineman. You get a Tate Ratledge or a Dylan Fairchild or something like that. Another one of those Georgia guys that tested really well athletically. Or you get one of those players who played offensive tackle but might kick inside for you. So I hear where Seahawks fans would be coming from, not addressing the interior offensive line, but you got to think about just overall draft strategy as a whole. And I think that the sweet spot for that is actually in round 2 and 3, especially with all the picks they have there.
Oh, no. Yeah. This draft has enough depth, I think, for them to attack the second. Like, it'll be one of those situations where, again, it's the first round pick goes to, again, a guy I really like here for Seattle in this particular defense. And then again, we're taking wide receivers, we're taking interior offensive line on the second day because they have some of those picks. I mean, you mentioned the Stanford wide out there. I mean, I think he'd be a really good fit as the X receiver in like a traditional Shanahan offense. And I think that's what they're installing here with Kubiak. You also mentioned Matthew Golden, though. I could see those like Rashid Shaheed big crossers and post routes and stuff like that against cover three, like just what they were running last season. I mean, I can really, down there with Clint Kubiak, I could see that fit as well. But overall, I do really like this fit here. You kind of like an ideal snap split for Emanwari, or is that like a little too like a little too minutia of a question?
No, I don't have necessarily like a specific one. I like him so much more when he's coming downhill. Like, I think some people, again, some people talk about Nicky Manwari as like this top 15, top 12 lock. You can't let an alien player like this get any further down the draft and all that. And I there are times when I feel like he's a little bit stiff in coverage, where coverage is what matters most. You know, you want to be a great athlete, but you've got to be able to impact the passing game the most. And so I'm just not fully, like, again, we're not having the same conversation that we had with Kyle Hamilton that we have with Nicky Manwari, in my opinion. Even with the ball, like, some people be like, well, look at all the ball protection he had. Go watch his interceptions. A couple of his interceptions this past year were just like literal Christmas gifts under the tree. Like, nobody's around him. Horrendous throw. Quarterback just doesn't even know what's going on. And Emanwari just happens to be there. So I don't quite think that he is that coverage player. I would like him the most in a defense that's going to play, that has the ability to play cover one opportunities, where he is that just true middle of the field defender. Like, he is playing that cover one robber role, where he is playing close to where the linebackers are, where he can play some tight ends in man coverage. Although I do worry a little bit about the hips when it comes to the man coverage roles, but I think he's got the strength and the overall athleticism to be able to work it, and then using him as a blitzer too. So I don't know what the exact snap splits would be, but I almost like him the most as more of a linebacker technically than a safety, just because he gets to play at the second level and quarterbacks have to be like, okay, where is Emanwari? Because he could be one spot the next, one spot this second, and then another spot the next second. And I think as a second level defender, that could have a big time threat on quarterbacks.
Well, you just mentioned him coming downhill. The Seahawks were sixth from week 10 on in rushing EPA allowed. You know, again, they have like mercenary defensive tackle, run stuffer, Jonathan Hankins. They have Leonard Williams, like I mentioned. They brought back Jaron Reed. And then you get a guy that's just kind of crashing on that those run games, like coming downhill like that. I really do overall like a lot of what you're laying out here for this one. Okay, let's go to your fifth favorite pick here and the final one from your most recent mock draft.
All right, final one I got. No idea if this happens. History tells me it probably won't. Luther Burden III, the wide receiver of Missouri, going to the Philadelphia Eagles at 32.
I have seen
so many mock drafts with Luther Burden sliding. And it feels like every new mock draft I read, it's like, yeah, you know, Luther Burden. All right, top 10. All right, top 12. All right, you know, more towards top 20. Okay, probably somewhere in the 20s. And now I've read mock drafts where Luther Burden's not even going in the first round. If he makes it to 32 with Philly, I understand this is not Howie's MO, but the pushback that I would give to people is you build the way that you have to give yourself ultimate flexibility. They have these reserves along the offensive and defensive line still to be able, because people say, no, 32, no matter what, it's a trench player. This is how Howie drafts. I think that they could certainly still go trench player, especially because I think that this draft lends itself to that. But dude, Luther Burden III with Devontae Smith, with A.J. Brown, I like the little that I've seen from Jahan Dotson. I know that they added Anaya Smith. They've got Johnny Wilson. But, like, those guys aren't stopping you from drafting Luther Burden III. Thing that I think we should take away the most from what Howie has done, it's not necessarily that he's just going to lock in on offensive or defensive line no matter what. It's the fact that Howie is never afraid to make a strength even stronger. So if Luther Burden III is on the board at 32, he realizes that he could set up just an insanely elite wide receiver trio with A.J. Brown, Devontae Smith, Luther Burden III. And if Jahan Dotson's your wide receiver 4 from even what we saw in the Super Bowl this past year, you're feeling pretty good about that, especially with some of the rookies you've drafted over the last couple of seasons as well. So no idea if this happens, but along the lines of Howie just leaning into making a strength stronger, and with this being one of the best rosters in the NFL coming off a Super Bowl win, Burden to Philly, I think, would be hilarious embarrassment of riches and a lot of fun to watch.
Well, I totally buy it from like a making strengths stronger perspective, because that is what the Eagles have done. And they also, they buy into premium positions, and wide receiver is a premium position. Now, they have A.J. Brown locked up for the long term. They have Devontae Smith locked up for the long term. And like you mentioned, Jahan Dotson, who I do have like a candle still lit for Jahan Dotson, that in the right situation, I think he could be a useful player. Like, he's useful for the Eagles, but I mean, like, that dude couldn't buy a target last year when everybody was healthy. It took until the Week 18 game when everybody was resting. That then, of course, he gets like double-digit targets. He goes over 90 yards. I'm like, see? He's got to get a couple footballs thrown his way, and maybe he can still be a productive player. So that's my only concern, is that there's just, I think too many mouths to feed can is really it's only a problem for bad teams. Like, oh, the Bears have too many mouths to feed. Well, yeah, they actually do, because they can't do anything. They can't do right on offense, right? The Eagles can do things correctly on offense, and so they could probably incorporate a guy here like Luther Burden. But I'm curious on, like, just your thoughts on where he should slot in, not where he will slot in, because I'm obviously still early into my work on the wide receivers here, and I really like a lot of what Burden brings to the table, even in this 2024 season where people is like, oh, it's a down year, all that stuff. I get the production was down, but you see ability to beat man coverage from the slot. You see an ability to, okay, this is a guy who can design targets and he can do things with the ball in his hands. I know this is not like the most exciting player in the world, but what if he's like a souped up version of Khalil Shakir, who just got a big extension from the Buffalo Bills, actually a value extension from the Buffalo Bills, frankly. But Shakir can get open quickly, he can beat man coverage, and he is great with the ball in his hands. And I think Burden, like, that's maybe the worst case scenario for him as a player like that.
Dude, and I agree. And a souped up version of Khalil Shakir, every team in the NFL would take a player like that,
yeah.
given how productive that he has been. I think that Luther Burden should absolutely be a top 20 pick in this draft. I'm going to have him as a top 15 player. I don't know exactly where it's going to be, but I'm going to have him as a top 15 player when it's all said and done. I think that some people look at Burden and, you know, you're a guy who studies wide receivers so so in just such a detailed manner of how they get open and how they win and how translatable it is compared to their athletic ability and their size and all that. And so for you to sort of have some faith in Luther Burden makes me feel better about it, because I understand that, like, his route tree, especially this past year, it wasn't super diverse. They weren't asking him to do a ton of stuff. But when I watch the caliber of an athlete he is when it comes to agility, body control, stop and start ability, one cut ability, when I watch all of him, when I watch him do all of those things with the ball in his hands in yards after catch instances, I tell myself, okay, well, that movement skill is there to then be a really great route runner and a really great separator. So I still think that Burden can be a focal point of an offense, of somebody who can really, really help out what you're doing in a variety of different ways. I don't think he is just a slot receiver either. Like, I think he's somebody who could be a Z, who you can move around before the snap, who can really put a lot of stresses on defenses because he's a threat when he gets the ball in his hands immediately. He can be a threat deep down the field. I think that he is somebody that should be mocked at a lot higher than what I am seeing. I think that he should be a target for the Seattle Seahawks. I think that he should be a target for the Pittsburgh Steelers. I think he should be a target for the Los Angeles Chargers. Like, all of those teams, I think, could use a player like Luther Burden. Houston Texans the same way, although they totally dismantled their offensive line in free agency, so I don't even know if they're going to have that flexibility anymore. But I think anywhere... Shoot, I mean, I would love him in Dallas. Doesn't feel like Dallas is going to draft him at number 12, but like, that's another spot that I think would be a good landing spot for him. Number 9, the New Orleans Saints. There's just some uncertainty with what could happen moving forward with their wide receivers. Now, again, I don't think they'll take him, but those are all landing spots where, in my opinion, I think Luther Burden could make sense for those teams.
Yeah, again, I like Burden a lot, and you mentioned like studying the position in detail and like charting routes and all this stuff. The first play I watched of him, this is not actually how I would do things, but the first play I watched of him, it was against Texas A&M. He runs like a go route from the outside on the sideline and like wins a contested pass. It's like, oh, this is the guy that all I hear about is Mickey Mouse routes and little pop gun targets and stuff, because I think he tracks the ball really well in tight coverage. And so it's like, what, you just don't see a lot of it. That's the thing. And even like reps against press, you don't see a lot of it, because in the games I've charted, he's like 88% snap slot player. He's almost always off the line. And like college football, you don't get as much true press coverage anyway, so the reps are really small against press man, but the reps are really good. So again, it's like you're kind of having to extrapolate here. So yeah, obviously this here to the Eagles would be a true embarrassment of riches, because even if he is not even souped up, even if he's just Khalil Shakir, it's like, well, my God, like, that's the best third receiver in the league and what might already be the best wide receiver duo in the league.
Yeah, no, 100%. I mean, no idea if it happens, but when I had Luther falling in the first round, I was like, there's not a chance in hell I'm letting him get past the Philadelphia Eagles, because Philly does the move all the time where they make you post that he can't keep getting away with this meme. And if the Eagles got Luther Burden at 32, it would just be an auto send of that Breaking Bad meme again.
Well, I'm not rooting for it, because I do want like Jahan Dotson to have a couple little moments here and there. So I'm not rooting for this to happen. And frankly, I feel it in my bones that the Eagles are trading out of that 32nd pick anyways to just collect more draft capital and take more trench players on day 2. But I do like the Luther Burden talk. So I enjoyed that discussion there. We're going to take our final break. We come back, we will find out who is the player that Trevor Sikkema wants to stand on the table for this draft season right after this. All right, we're back, and it is time for Trevor to stand on the table.
Captain, my captain.
Sit down, Mr. Anderson.
We have Bills Mafia here.
Let's go!
NJ, through the table!
All right, Trevor, who is the prospect in this year's draft you are willing to stand on the table for?
When people ask me who is my guy, this is the first name that always comes to my mind. It is UCF running back RJ Harvey. I think that RJ Harvey is such a fun football player, and after a really good showing at the combine, especially when it came to long speed, you just check so many boxes for him now as a running back, as a receiver, basically everything. We have a couple of stats that I absolutely love to lean on over at pff.com and all of our databases that is there when it comes to how do we separate guys at the running back position? A lot of these guys are really productive, but sometimes you go, okay, well, how do you separate what they're doing from the offenses that they're in, and specifically the offensive line that blocks in front of them? Well, the two stats that we have that I like the most that can do that, missed tackles forced per attempt. Okay, so how often are you making guys miss? That has nothing to do with your offensive line, right? If whether it's in the backfield, whether it's at the line of scrimmage, or whether it's to the second level and beyond, how often you are making guys miss, that can happen anywhere. And then yards after contact, yards after contact per attempt. Again, averages, so it takes away the volume statistics, just averages there. How many yards are you getting after you get contact? And again, that could be totally independent of your offensive line. You get hit in the backfield, you get hit at the line of scrimmage, you get hit at the second level. How much are you still able to gain yards after contact there? And those two categories, RJ Harvey grades incredibly well and incredibly efficient. Over the last 3 years in which he has been a starter, he has had a missed tackles forced per attempt average above 0.30, which is really good. I mean, a lot of even good backs in the college level, you want something at least above a 0.20. Like, that's what you at least want from the running back position. If you are in the threes, if you are 0.30 and above, that's really good. Anything in the fours, like a 0.40, is just like crazy good. That's like Bijan Robinson numbers. You know, Javonte Williams was like that when he was at UNC. Travis Etienne was like that when he was at Clemson. Trey Benson, when he was at his best, had those really high numbers as well in college. Like, those are crazy numbers. But over the last 3 years, from 2022 to 2024, RJ Harvey, 0.32, 0.34, 0.30. So this dude has consistently throughout his entire career, when he has been involved in the offense or been a starter, has given you efficient numbers. When it comes to yards after contact, anything above three and a half is really good. 3.6, 3.6, 3.8. He reminds me so much in rushing style and efficiency, the way that Bucky Irving was in his 2 years as a starter when he was at Oregon. When you look at Bucky Irving's numbers in the 2 years that he was a starter, 0.42 when it came to missed tackles forced per attempt, and then 0.38, so a little bit higher than Harvey's. I'm not saying that he's quite Bucky Irving, but then you look at the yards after contact per attempt, 4.3, and then a 3.9. So again, Irving's numbers are a little bit higher than Harvey, but in my opinion, he's that same archetype type of a player. Irving was obviously unbelievable his rookie season with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, so I don't quite think that Harvey's going to be exactly that. But those are two traits that I absolutely love, that I gravitate towards. Your playmaker mentality, how much you can make guys miss in a phone booth, how much contact balance you have, and you love to get those yards after contact, and of course, what they can do as a receiver as well, which I think RJ Harvey can give you a plus as a receiver too. So the reason why I'm standing on the table for him is because I had Bucky Irving RB5 last year, and clearly, I was still too low on him for how good he was, but I felt like I was the highest on Bucky Irving, again, because of those traits that I gravitate towards. Harvey reminds me the most of Irving in that sort of situation there, so he is my guy that I would stand on the table for in this class.
Man, I love it. That was a great stand on the table. I don't know anything about RJ Harvey other than I've seen how productive he is, just like looking at it, just kind of the backs in this class. And I think the only other thing I know about him is that I think he was the guy you mentioned when we had dinner together at the combine, when EJ asked you like what running backs you like. I think, and I was like, okay, RJ Harvey, that I believe was the name that you told EJ, friend of the show, of course. That is it. That is all I know about RJ Harvey as a player. So like, why? I mean, again, I haven't really heard his name from many other people, and I also ran a 4.4 at the combine, I believe.
Yeah.
So like, why is he not a guy that's talked about more? Is it just the depth of the class, or is there something missing from his profile or something?
No,
like that?
In my opinion, I mean, he's a little bit smaller. People sort of question the long speed. So like, those concerns and those, I would say, priors like are hard to sort of, they're hard to get over. Like if you watch running back and you go, oh, okay, well, I don't think he's the fastest guy in the world. And even if he runs really well at the combine, you'll probably just doubt that always, especially because there's a lot of running backs to know. I mean, the two Ohio State guys, Quinshon Judkins, Trayvon Henderson, Caleb Johnson from Iowa, Omarion Hampton from UNC. That's not even mentioning Ashton Jeanty at the very top. Like, all of those guys are regarded higher than RJ Harvey. But then when you get into that next tier right after that, I would tell you that Devin Neal from Kansas, RJ Harvey, DJ Giddens from Kansas State, like all those guys are sort of right there. So in my opinion, The only reason why he's not getting talked about more is because he's not as physically gifted as like a Quinshon Judkins or a Caleb Johnson or an Omarion Hampton. He's not as explosive as a Travion Henderson or Omarion Hampton or like maybe even a Dylan Sampson, like guys like that. But he has, again, it's those two statistics that I love so much about his game. And I love the same about Cam Scadaboo as well, who in my opinion is getting underrated in this running back room because, okay, sure, he doesn't have as great as long speed as with other guys. How many opportunities do you have to bust off not even 50, 60-yard runs? How often do you have to bust out 30, 40-yard runs in the NFL? Almost never. Defenses are way too organized. They're way too disciplined. Instead, give me the guy that's going to give me efficiency numbers every time he touches the ball. Does he make you miss as a tackler? And he's going to run behind his pads and give you those yards after contact. RJ Harvey's just one of those guys that does that. So I keep leaning into what he could be as a pro. Obviously, the fit and the situation matters. Bucky Irving was in a perfect situation in Tampa where they did not already have this entrenched RB1. And as things were getting a little bit stagnant in the beginning of the year, they were able to lean on him a little bit more. And so you saw great production from him as a rookie. But I really do feel as though if RJ Harvey goes to a good situation, he'll be able to be very, very productive even as a rookie contract.
I love it. Well, certainly, like, the Dynasty Bros listening to this, or, you know, obviously it's a big, great running back class. I think there's a lot of early picks. Like, who are the kind of later sleeper type players? So, great name for standing on the table. Well, speaking of standing on the table and speaking of our dinner at the Combine, again, I want to come back to this before I let you go, Trevor. Mm-hmm. Tell the other people, like, backstory here. I'll be real quick on this. When I'm going to be out late for a night, I'm starting the dinner every single time with the espresso martini. Two reasons for this. Number one, I'm washed.
first and foremost, right off the bat, I'm washed.
First and foremost, I'm absolutely washed. And I'm also a contrarian at heart. So like there was kind of an espresso martini craze maybe a couple of years ago, 2-3 years ago. And of course, I'm like, oh my God, these people, just a bunch of sheep, whatever. But my wife and I honeymooned in Puerto Rico 2 years after our wedding because just life happens, whatever. We take our honeymoon 2 years later in Puerto Rico, and we go to this great food tour in Old San Juan, but it's humid as hell. We're tired after the whole thing, but we're like, we're on our honeymoon. We can't just be turning in at damn 8 o'clock. We go down to one of the restaurants at the place we stayed at, and she's like, just order an espresso martini. Trust me. And I mean, this is literally what an addiction is. I'm still chasing that feeling that I got that night from my first one and how much that just completely changed our entire night. We were ready to rock from that point on. Anyway, so I've been an espresso martini truther because I'm washed and I need the energy. But also, I love the reaction that you get from the table. Same happened that night, happened every dinner I do it at. You like, you order an espresso martini first thing off, everyone goes, ooh, like, yeah, yeah. So I'm washed. I like the reaction. So I order the espresso martini at this dinner Trevor and I has. And you stand on the table for a little bit of a twist on this. So tell the people about it all.
Yeah, so I also enjoy a good espresso martini, but not too long ago, maybe a year ago, my friend opened my eyes to a sibling of the espresso martini, but more in old-fashioned form. Obviously, a martini is a martini. You know what that is right off the bat. But there's this drink called the Carajillo, which he introduced me to, which is basically the espresso martini in like old-fashioned form. And it's pretty simple. It is espresso. It is a liqueur called Liquor 43, which is, I believe, made in Mexico, which has 43 different ingredients. And it's really hard to like say exactly what people are like, oh, what is it? What is it like? I mean, like, it's kind of like rum, but like a dark rum, but not really. It's just very different. You just got to try it to understand it. So it's a little bit of that. It's 2 ounces of that. It's 2 ounces of an espresso. And then the really good places they might throw, if they've got like chocolate or banana bitters, they'll throw a little bit of that in there. Then they'll get a little bit of cinnamon on the top. They'll grind a little bit of cinnamon on the very top. And it is excellent. If you are a coffee drinker out there and you are an espresso martini lover, try out the Carajillo next time you're out. If the bartender knows exactly what it is, you're in for a wild ride and it's going to be a fantastic taste bud experience. So I am glad that I opened your eyes up to it because my eyes were opened as well a year ago when I had it for the first time. And I feel like I have also been chasing that high ever since.
I mean, again, I'm a man who listens to good advice and a good sales pitch. That was a great pitch. So about 2 or 3 nights later at the Combine, I'm having dinner with producer Colin at a very nice steakhouse down, of course, a steakhouse in Indianapolis. I go, hey, can you make me one of these Carjillos? And he goes, yeah. And I had it. It was awesome. Totally endorsed. I sent a picture of it to Trevor and I say, you know, ball, bro. Like, so you know, ball, you know, booze, let's go. So I had to get that recommendation on the table. I haven't had one since, because I typically don't, well, number one, I don't try not to drink too much. I try not to take in things that are, have too many ingredients. That's the only thing in the world I'm like, oh, 43 ingredients, sign me up. Usually I'm like, let's make that ingredient list a little smaller. And I don't really drink too much caffeine after noon or after that late. But again, I'm washed. And when you're going to be in Indianapolis for the combine, you're out till 3 a.m, you're going to need a little lighter fluid to get this thing started. So great recommendation by Trevor Sikkema. Great podcast by Trevor Sikkema. People out there, if they're not following your work already, Trevor, they're absolutely missing out. Tell the people what you're working on, what they can check out here leading up to the NFL draft.
Yeah, absolutely. All my NFL draft stuff over at pff.com. We're updating the big board. We're updating the mock draft simulator as free agency is going on and after free agency as well. So we'll be cooking with gas, as they say, cooking with Carjillos, maybe just to stick yes. with the theme of the show there. We'll be wired and ready as we get towards the NFL draft. And then, if you guys want a draft podcast, another draft podcast, because it does feel like there's a million of them, NFL Stock Exchange with myself and Connor Rogers talking NFL draft every single week. So check me out there as well.
Yeah, Trevor and Connor do great work together. Everybody should definitely give that podcast or subscribe on YouTube. Check it out as well. So that is going to do it for today's show. Again, shout out to Trevor. This was fantastic. Tomorrow, I'm going to put a bow on free agency coverage with a special free agency panic meter episode. We look at the players, teams, situation that people could be a little nervous about after a chaotic week of moves. Until then, we are out.